So I'll begin by saying that February is an interesting month in many ways. There are many things I could have given a Dharma talk about tonight. Today is President's Day. You know, last Friday was Lincoln's birthday. It was also the Chinese New Year last week. And Ash Wednesday is this coming Wednesday. Tomorrow is Mardi Gras. And any of these might have made good Dharma talks. But what I felt calling to me was the fact that yesterday was Valentine's Day, and so I'm actually going to talk about romantic love today. And I guess the first thing I'll start with, technically, of course, the name is Saint Valentine's Day. This was actually a person. He was a Valentine, or Valentinus, as he would have been known, was a Christian priest. He was eventually killed for his faith, because this was before Christianity was made legal. He lived in the 3rd century. And so his feast day throughout from Roman times onward has been February 14th. Why his name and his feast day have gotten associated with romantic love is a bit paradoxical. It seems to be a tradition that started somehow in the Middle Ages. Chaucer had a role in it. It's not well understood, and there are, of course, legends that were later attributed to him. You know, he provided Christian marriages for young lovers, you know, this kind of thing. But it's somewhat arbitrary that this man's name has gotten associated with romantic love. And really, the idea of romantic love, that's part of the irony, romantic love didn't even exist when the real man lived. Romantic love, as we understand it, really was created in the late Middle Ages. It was a creation of the troubadour cultures in the 12th or 13th century. It was really a revolutionary new cultural movement that grew out of the Middle Ages. And Joseph Campbell has argued that really this ideal of romantic love. So this is, how can I say this? Of course, you know, sexuality has been around forever, and sexual love and sexual, you know, all the emotions that go with sexuality, that's been around forever. You know, and compassion and friendship and things like that have been around forever. But this idea that there's one other person for me, that I have, as it were, a soulmate, and that our eyes meet, and, you know, that person completes, you know, that's the other half of me that I find. You know, this is very much the romantic love story. And it's very much a story that focuses on individualism, unlike previous loves. You know, sexual love is not necessarily individualistic. It can be very indiscriminate sexual love, but romantic love is about finding that one other person, and it's very much about individuality. And so Joseph Campbell has argued that romantic love was actually the driving force for the entire movement around individuality that has gone through Western civilization, rights of man, and, you know, we hold these truths self-evident, all men are created equal, all the individual rights that we now take so, you know, reflexively, in some sense have come from this love tradition. I also think it's a little bit comical, incidentally, to, you know, when someone says, be my Valentine, you're really, in a way, saying, be my Roman priest and martyr, but that's another story. So romantic love, there's so much to say about this. How does romantic love look from a Buddhist perspective, you know? And of course, the first thing that may seem like an apparent contradiction is, of course, Buddhism urges us to have universal compassion for everyone. And so in this framework where we're supposed to have universal compassion, does it make sense to focus on one other person, you know? And it's funny, it's subtle, because, you know, we can use this term universal compassion, but in some sense that's a head term, you know, and if we go up into our head, it's a very shallow thing. The only way that universal compassion actually plays out is when I actually go out into the world and in the rough and tumble of everyday life, I'm compassionate to all the different individuals I meet, you know? You know, we can't live out abstract ideas. We can only live out concrete things. But I think I would say also to live in our wholeness, part of our wholeness is our sexuality, is our desire for connection, for companionship. For many people, it's an important part of our wholeness. And how can I say, you know, insofar as enlightenment is anything, it's a kind of a grand yes to everything in the world and everything that I am, you know. And it's true, there are some people who live celibate, but I think I would say, you know, monks living in community in, you know, meditating 8 hours a day and doing the brahmacharya practices, the yogic practices to support celibacy, like they're actualizing their sexuality in other ways, you know, and I have no doubt about that path can lead to human wholeness also. But short of that, I would say romantic love is something important for all of us who are not living that kind of, you know, ritualistic celibate life. I'll also say that, you know, there are these statements deep in the Buddhist tradition that for pursuing the spiritual path, it's better to be a renunciant than a householder, you know. And I've heard people use this as an excuse for, you know, thinking it might be a bad idea to date, or is dating, you know, gonna compromise my practice or this sort of thing. And it's very funny because, you know, first of all, I don't think it's good to be a Buddhist fundamentalist. But if we look at the worldview from which Buddhism came, first of all, the historical Buddha lived in a time when most people were living to maybe 30, 40, maybe 50 years old, you know. People either lived in extended families, and so you got married and two families joined and you're living with an extended family, or they were living in religious community. And either way, they were living with people and all the intimacy that comes with living with people, whether that's family life or whether that's religious community life, you know. And what's very different about our time, first of all, you know, we live much longer than that. And it's curious, we have a culture in which people are dating in their 40s and their 50s and their 60s and their 70s, maybe even in their 80s and 90s, you know. And also, it's unusual. We live in a time when a period in history in which there's the phenomena of single people who live alone, you know, and that didn't exist in most of human history. That certainly did not exist in the time of the Buddha, you know. And so I think I would say, you know, it's subtle, you know, there, I think everyone has periods when, you know, certainly there are periods when it might be healthy for someone to live alone as they're, when they're getting away from something, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. And we're all wired for connection, you know. We're deeply wired for connection, and connection is so important to us in so many ways. And I think in the modern world, how can I say, romance between two people who are practitioners actually is a very powerful practice and something that very much can enhance practice. And so it's a somewhat different situation than the original Buddhist scriptures had in mind. I also want to talk about this funny word, attachment, which has two very different meanings. And it's almost unfortunate that these two very different traditions have grabbed onto this word. And of course, so Buddhism talks about attachment, and in Buddhism, attachment is a problem. Attachment leads to suffering. This is essentially the second noble truth of Buddhism. And attachment in that sense is grasping, holding on to things, wanting to hold on to pleasure or hold on to my worldview or ultimately even hold on to my ego, you know, grasping. Very different from the psychologist's idea of attachment in what's called attachment theory, of forming an emotional bond with somebody. And briefly, attachment theory talks about secure attachment, avoidant attachment, and anxious attachment. So secure attachment is when I'm feeling comfortable in a bond, comfortable in intimacy with somebody else. Avoidant attachment is when it starts to get intimate, I back away. I don't want that. And anxious attachment is when I'm very clingy. You know, I need this to work, you know, this sort of thing. And there are ways that both the anxious and the avoidant attachment are caused by the Buddhist kind of bad attachments, you know. In avoidant attachment, I'm very much attached to my fears. I'm very much attached to my story of my fears and fear of intimacy. In anxious attachment, there's a powerful scarcity narrative. I'm not enough. I need somebody else to fill me because I'm not enough, you know. And really, secure attachment, I might say, is a dynamic balance between these two, not falling off to the side of fear or to the side of scarcity. And even the attachment theorists will say that, you know, someone who is predominantly secure in attachment, you know, in a time of tremendous stress, I may well fall off to one side or the other because it's a hard balance to maintain. It's the balance of I am totally happy and grounded in myself. I'm totally happy with where I am. I'm full. I don't need anything else. And I'm willing to risk myself. I'm willing to risk myself in intimacy to connect with somebody else. And so it's a very powerful place to be in that place of secure attachment. And what is the risk of intimacy? There's many ways to frame this. You may be familiar with the psychologist Erik Erikson. He's the one who came up with the eight stages of the life cycle. He's the psychologist who coined the term identity crisis and midlife crisis. In Erikson's view, the principal task of adolescence was identity. Who am I? Who am trying to figure out who I am? What's my role in the world? Figuring that out during adolescence. And in young adulthood, as people start moving toward relationship, the challenge was intimacy. And in Erikson's scheme, in any strength that you developed in one stage got tested or threatened as you moved into the next stage. Like the thing that you worked on and got really good at, that was the thing that got put at risk in the next stage, you know. And sure enough, identity is something that gets put at risk when we start exploring intimacy, you know. And Erikson was very clear that these are the big tasks of adolescence and young adulthood, but that these lessons cycle through life so that there are, you know, there can be many different points in life in which we're wrestling with identity or having identity crises and then re-meeting the challenge of intimacy, this sort of thing. Intimacy is scary. Intimacy is a risk. Romance, in many ways, involves risk. One way to say it, I like the way that David White uses this distinction of, you know, the right kind of danger. We need to find the right kind of danger in life, you know. We all know about the wrong kind of danger, you know. We may have even dated the wrong kind of danger, you know. But we need the right kind of danger. And ultimately, dating and the choice to enter intimacy is about taking that risk, about finding in the other person the right kind of danger. The kind of danger that will push me in the direction of growth, that will unsettle me in the direction of growth. And so it takes a certain amount of courage. And I think I would say that anyone who's saying, you know, my primary concern is safety, I want to be safe, you know, in a way that's a romance killer, you know, because romance is about the courage to take a risk. And similarly, for people that have been in relationship for a while, there's certainly a tendency to get comfortable and to get safe, and everything feels nice and safe. And when everything's nice and comfortable and safe, often the spark dies and things start to feel flat, and both parties feel kind of frustrated. you know, and you know, what needs to happen is both parties need to get dangerous toward each other again. And typically the way that happens is that at a certain point, someone's frustrated enough, they bring up a conversation, you know, I've been, you know, the story is I've been holding this conversation because I wanted to protect the other, but then this conversation comes spilling out. And then because that conversation opens, a bunch of other conversations come spilling out, you know, and then next thing you know, people are again raw and connected, and then the spark is back, you know. And so it takes that, almost that commitment to the right kind of danger. And I'll say that, you know, at one point, somebody asked David White a question, how do you tell the right kind of danger from the wrong kind of danger? You know, and there's no formula. There's no, you know, we learn it through experience. We learn it through making mistakes and having encounters with the wrong kind of danger and learning from that and, you know, not making that mistake again. And, but even in the best of relationships, you know, even in a relationship where two people are suited to each other, where they're providing the right kind of risk for each other and pushing each other's growth, there's going to be times that one person or the other is triggered. One person or the other is, hold on, I've got a software thing that is happening. All right. There's going to be times that someone is triggered. And you know, the moment that I'm triggered, then I'm providing my partner with the wrong kind of danger. You know, then I may be insulting or hurting or, you know, this sort of thing. And that's human, you know. And if two people are going to spend any extended time with each other, that's going to be part of it, you know. And so forgiveness is such a tremendously important part of maintaining any kind of long-term relationship, you know. If two people spend any extended period with each other, each one is going to see an ugly face of the other, you know. And in fact, the healing comes when we realize that even with my ugly face being out, I can still be accepted for who I am, you know. There's the deep healing in that. So one writer, David Riccio, talks about what he likes to call the five A's of adult relationships. Attention, affection, acceptance, appreciation, and allowing. And of course, there's lots to say about all five of those. Attention, you know, love is, among other things, attention. You know, if someone's important to us, one of the best ways we can do that, show that, is just by paying attention. And I often say that we have such a deficit mentality in our culture about attention. You know, we think of it just in terms of a black or white, you know, is someone paying attention or not? We don't really think about the quality of attention, the various levels of attention, you know. Am I paying attention just from a head level? Am I paying attention from a grounded whole body place? Am I paying attention with inner silence? You know, the various kinds of attention. And I think it's really wonderful if we can become more connoisseurs of attention and offer the people in our lives a higher quality of attention. Probably one of the hardest of the five is allowing the other person to be as they are, you know? And again, this goes back to the Buddhist kind of attachment. You know, someone becomes important to me, so I want them to stay in that way, you know, stay in that way that they make me happy, you know? And believe it or not, that other person's role in life is not to make me happy, you know? So, you know, just the tremendous generosity of spirit it takes to allow the other person to be as they are. And so love in its highest level involves a tremendous amount of letting go. The mystics might say that in love, there's not two, there's actually three. There's the two lovers and then the love that binds them. This is an archetype that plays out in many other sacred systems. For example, the Christian Trinity is sometimes characterized as the lover, the loved one, and the love that binds them. When two people love each other, their love becomes a kind of energetic container. And when people are, as it were, working on the relationship, they're working on this energetic container. I think we get into a lot of trouble if I think that I surrender to the other person or the other person surrenders to me, but we both surrender to the love. You know, that's a very different thing. And so it's just interesting to play with the idea of, you know, especially if you're in relationship, of what is that third thing and what is the quality of that third thing? Could each of us engage that third thing in a conversation and learn from it, you know? So at this point, I'm going to share the quote sheet. And the top of the quote sheet is one of my favorite poems by E.E. Cummings. It's not specifically about romantic love, but it certainly applies to romantic love as well as all other kinds of love. Love is a place, and through this place of love move with brightness of peace all places. Yes is a world, and in this world of yes live skillfully curled all worlds. That is a profound poem at many levels. Rumi said, "Let yourself be silently drawn by the stronger pull of what you really love." Jeremy Taylor said, "Love is friendship set on fire." The playwright Molière said, "Love is a great master. It teaches us to be what we never were." Felix Adler said, "Love is the expansion of two natures in such fashion that each includes the other, each is enriched by the other." Jung said, "The meeting of two personalities is like the contact of two chemical substances. If there is any reaction, both are transformed." Einstein said, "Love is a better teacher than duty." And similar, Eleanor Roosevelt said, "The giving of love is an education in itself." Bishop Fulton Sheen said, "It takes three to make love, not two, you, your spouse, and God. Without God, people only see it in bringing out the worst in one another. Lovers who have nothing else to do but love each other soon find there is nothing else. Without a central loyalty, life is unfinished." And so the God language might not work for you, but just to think of, again, love as something higher than my ego or the ego of the other person. F. Scott Fitzgerald said, "There are all kinds of love in this world, but never the same love twice." Antoine Saint-Exupéry, author of The Little Prince, says, "Love does not consist in gazing at each other, but in looking outward together in the same direction." Anais Nin said, "And the day came when the risk it took to remain tight inside the bud was more painful than the risk it took to blossom." You know? And what would it mean for your heart to blossom? You know? Thomas Merton said, "The beginning of love is to let those we love be perfectly themselves, not to twist them to fit our own image. Otherwise, we love only the reflection of ourselves we find in them." The Jungian Robert Johnson said, "It is almost always the case that whatever has wounded you will also be instrumental in your healing." The wise man James Baldwin said, "Love takes off the masks that we fear we cannot live without and know we cannot live within." Thich Nhat Hanh said, "To love, first of all, is to accept ourselves as we actually are. And it's true, the more I can love and accept myself, the more genuine love I have to give to anyone else." Maya Angelou says, love recognized no barriers. It jumps hurdles, leaps fences, penetrates wall to arrive at its destination full of hope. Bruce Lee said quite practically, I'm not in the world to live up to your expectations, and you're not in the world to live up to mine. Jack Kornfield said, in the end, we discover that to love and let go can be the same thing. Barbara DeAngelis says, love's greatest gift is the ability to make everything it touches sacred. The poet David White says, I often talk about the conversational nature of reality, the fact that whatever you think you are never survives meeting anything other than you, and anyone in an intimate relationship knows whoever you woke with in the morning does not survive the first conversation in the kitchen with your spouse or loved one or partner. You're into something that's more a frontier, something that quite often disturbs you, subverts you, and is almost always asking you to be bigger than yourself. Lev Grossman said, that was the thing about the world. It wasn't that things were harder than you thought they were going to be. It was that they were hard in ways that you didn't expect. And that's a really good description of a good, healthy love, that it's hard in ways that you didn't expect. Donald Miller said, when you stop expecting people to be perfect, you can like them for who they are. Reshma Menakin says, our virtues are wrapped inside our limitations. It is only when we are in close proximity to others that we begin to intimately explore the boundaries of our virtues by slamming into our limitations. That's brilliant. And Naval Ravikant says, just be you, and wait for the people who want that.